Good day to you all around the world. Greetings from Geneva, Switzerland at the World Health Organization. Welcome to this teleclass series on infection control. Jenny Lippi will deliver today's lecture on TB infection control in high HIV burdened countries. The title of her lecture specifically is TB infection control in PEPFAR-supported countries in Africa. During the lecture, she will discuss multiple dimensions of this issue, including the burden associated or attributable to this issue, the approach that's being taken by PEPFAR, describing some WHO guidelines on TB infection control, and then delving into some challenges as well as available training materials, and really thinking through some practical interventions, including scale-up. WHO and WHO patient safety emphasize the importance of both knowledge and learning and infection prevention and control. Specifically in the context of this lecture, it's worthwhile remembering that the African region has moved forward in its agenda on patient safety and infection prevention and control. Back in 2008, in a regional committee meeting that brought together 46 ministries of health in Africa, a patient safety technical paper was endorsed, which included mention of infection prevention and control and knowledge and learning. Of course, knowledge and learning necessarily underpins infection prevention and control mechanisms, and that is particularly why I'm delighted to be able to introduce this teleclass. Translating global or regional policy into action and implementation at health facility level is, of course, a huge challenge, and it is really in this context that I welcome this teleclass that I'm sure you will find informative and thought-provoking. Most importantly, I hope it will catalyze change in your practice and indeed share and stimulate spread across countries and regions where you're working. Jenny Lippi has an impressive background. Her career started as an RN where she was bitten by the infectious disease bug, and she went on to specialize and certify in AIDS nursing and infection control. She obtained her Bachelor's of Science and a Master's in Healthcare Administrative Degrees in order to work within the healthcare system to advocate for evidence-based practices to improve patient outcomes. Jenny's been a member of the Association for Professionals in Infection Control, APIC, since 1999, and in 2007, she was honored as one of APIC's healthcare heroes. She has practiced in a variety of mediums to multi-center tertiary hospitals and is a past president of the Atlanta chapter of the Association of Nurses in AIDS Care and is a member of Sigma Theta Tau Nursing Honor Society. Jenny has served as content advisor for a number of infection control videos and has spoken nationally and internationally on how to implement infection prevention and operationalize safer work practices. Her work now at CDC's Global AIDS Program focuses on developing practical strategies and guidance for TB and HIV infection control activities for PEPFAR-supported countries. So we're very honored and privileged to have her deliver this teleclass. And in the context of TB being the most common presenting illness among people living with HIV, this is clearly a critical global issue. Knowing that over a million HIV-positive new TB cases globally in 2011, and the fact that around 80% of these patients lived in sub-Saharan Africa, it's particularly interesting to note that her teleclass is focusing in on the work in the African region. So let's, without further ado, move on to the teleclass. But before handing over to Jenny, I would like to point out that we will be unable to take live questions at the end of the teleclass. Time permitting, Jenny and I will have a short discussion following her class. But if you do have any questions, please do send them through via email, and I'm sure Jenny will be very happy to answer them. So without further ado, let me hand over to Jenny Lippi. Jenny.
Thank you, Shams, very much for that wonderful introduction, and I'm just delighted to be able to be on this teleclass and share with you some information regarding what's happening in TB infection control in PEPFAR-supported countries in Africa. As Shams mentioned, I will focus on TB infection control as it relates to the burden of TB-HIV co-infection as we see in Africa. So if we go to the second slide that you have in your slide set, I'm going to be going over the burden of TB-HIV co-infection in sub-Saharan Africa, the role of PEPFAR in the scale-up of care and treatment programs, also the WHO, the World Health Organization, 2009 policy on TB infection control, some of the challenges of TB infection control implementation that we see on the ground, and then the CDC TBIC, or TB infection control training package, what it offers, and where the package has been trialed already. And lastly, some considerations for countrywide scale-up of TB infection control strategies. So with this much material, let's get started on the next slide. As you can see, this is a background slide from the WHO, and in this 2012 World Health Organization report highlights the fact that TB continues to be a major infectious global disease that continues to kill an enormous number of people. Even though the total number of infections worldwide has been slowly falling since the middle of the last decade, of the 8.7 million incident cases, according to the World Health Organization, there were an estimated 1.4 million people who died from TB in 2011. And when you think of it demographically, half of these were women. As you'll note on the map, Africa shares a disproportionate TB incident burden. The next slide shows that the World Health Organization estimated HIV prevalence in new TB cases in 2011. And of that 1.4 million deaths that I had mentioned earlier from the previous slide, almost half a million, about 430,000, were HIV-positive TB deaths. So you can see that HIV fuels TB because persons with HIV have a weakened immune system and are therefore more susceptible to opportunistic infections like TB. They also have a much higher risk of TB infection rapidly turning into active TB disease. A person infected with TB but without an HIV infection usually has only a 5 to 10% risk of developing active TB disease through his or her lifetime. However, if a person is also HIV infected, the risk of developing active TB after a TB infection increases dramatically to 5 to 10% per year. So inadequate infection control really leads to risky environments for the emergence and transmission of TB, which is critically important for healthcare workers and patients who are at risk due to HIV infection. As you'll see on the next slide, PEPFAR was launched in 2003 by President George W. Bush. And PEPFAR stands for the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. It is the largest effort by any nation to combat a single disease. In the first 5 years of the program, PEPFAR focused on establishing scale-up of prevention, care, and treatment programs, and other things surrounding care and treatment and getting people on ART. It achieved its success in expanding access to HIV prevention, care and treatment, and low-resource settings. But before PEPFAR, global health and development programs were often judged largely on the amount of resources committed rather than on results achieved. During the first phase, PEPFAR supported the provision of treatment for over 2 million people and care for over 10 million, including more than 4 million orphans and vulnerable children. It also offered a lot of prevention of mother-to-child transmission and treatment services for nearly 16 million pregnancies. So that's a lot of pregnancies. Of significance is to note that, as you see on the graph, between 2008 and 2011, in the midst of the global economic recession, PEPFAR significantly increased the number of people supported on antiretroviral therapy. As you'll see on the next slide, PEPFAR provides critical infrastructure to support countries in addressing TB-HIV, including more than 13,500 HIV care and treatment sites, including over 2,000 of these sites providing directly ART therapy to patients. These activities have contributed substantially to the cumulative 1.3 million lives that were saved from 2005 to 2011 through collaborative TB-HIV interventions. Some of these interventions were to encourage countries to adopt task shifting to allow nurses and other cadres of healthcare workers to initiate both ART and TB treatment, to increase the access of TB screening and isoniazid preventive therapy. We also worked on supporting linkages to help patients remain on treatment until the treatment was completed, and other support measures to prevent the transmission of TB in healthcare facilities. In the next slide, you're going to see a photo of a very crowded waiting area. If for those of you that are listening that have been in the TB-HIV world for quite some time, you'll remember that in the early 2000s, universal access to antiretroviral therapy for HIV/AIDS first became available in Africa, and it created crowded waiting areas in most hospitals and clinics that were never designed for such high-volume use. Crowded waiting areas with very limited air movement, like the one shown, is the perfect scenario for the nosocomial transmission of TB. Recognizing the need for guidance, in 2009, the World Health Organization released the policy on TB infection control in healthcare settings, congregate settings, and households. It's aimed at national and subnational policymakers, including healthcare system managers, and is divided into the four key elements that most of us know, which is managerial, administrative, environmental, and personal protective equipment. Although providing the standards and the indicators for TB infection control, the policy doesn't provide the kind of how-to or the implementation details for clinic staff on how to adopt these measures and then to operationalize them within their healthcare setting. So that leads us sort of to the next slide. We believe that the way forward for TB infection control is by ensuring that tools, policies, and best practice models are readily available to the end user in a language and a format that can be easily understood, easily accessed, and easily implemented at their facility at little or no cost. And to meet this need, the World Health Organization, CDC, and the Dutch group, KNCV, created the implementation framework document that you see in the slide. And it's to show those designated infection control professionals that you have in your clinical setting how to get started. All of the examples and policies and tools and ideas that are in this booklet have been successfully implemented in other developing countries. And the text can be downloaded from the website that's located on your handout, which is the www.tbcta.org/library. And all of this material is free. But as my colleagues and I were traveling about to different countries and different political sites, we noted that there were a number of things that, to my mind, were still missing, that still weren't, you know, covered in the manual that we had created. When we went to these various facilities, we noticed that many countries had very good documents, or they may have had a copy of the Blue Implementation Book that we had created. But often that the staff and the administrators at the local clinic or small facility level did not have either internet access to get these documents, or they simply didn't have the time to read them. You know, they're so busy and they're so overworked. Some of them didn't even have copies of their own national guidelines. And so many countries have developed national guidelines based on the World Health Organization policy. And yet when we visit the clinical sites, we saw very little evidence that TB infection control measures were actually being practiced. Often, there were only maybe a handful or just a few what I call champions, people who stand up for and promote TB infection control on site. But often, the clinical administrators and other people who have direct influence over these clinical and ARV sites really didn't understand the need to analyze the risks within their facility. They didn't have sometimes the local capability to print the tools and the templates that are needed to actively work through these problems. And some didn't simply understand the strategies needed to operationalize these basic interventions into daily practice. And often the aspects of teaching and monitoring and mentoring and reminder tools are simply not readily available to them. We also noted that there were challenges in the actual training of healthcare workers. And as this next slide mentions, traditional train-the-trainer, and I have it abbreviated here on the slide, TOT, but traditional train-the-trainer's approach often in Africa would take workers away from the facility, which, you know, created a lot of downtime and a lot of burden on the workers who were left behind to stay and work in the facilities with the patients. Also, train-the-trainer's messages can vary between trainer to trainer, and so there wasn't necessarily a consistent message being reinforced by those trainers each and every time. Often, by using training-the-trainer formats, there's really no convenient or efficient means to provide pre-service or annual in-service to employees, to healthcare workers, on an annual basis or as you get new employees coming into your institution. And also, there was, of course, lack of consistent web access, so that even if you wanted to access things on the web, you really needed to have an alternative just in case you didn't have web access. So there were a number of things that we were concerned about. On the next slide, you'll see some other access aspects regarding training of healthcare workers on TB. So when our team at CDC looked at all the training solutions, what we really wanted to do boiled down to we wanted to reduce the costs to the country related to travel of the staff away from the clinic. If we could keep people in the clinic for training purposes, we thought that was the ideal. We also wanted a consistent message that reinforced TB infection control practices for all workers and complemented whatever materials that we were going to support. And what I mean by all workers is definitely all workers, not just nurses, not just physicians. It had to be everybody down to the person who cleans and tidies up the room and empties the trash. We wanted a portable, on-demand method of education that could be used as part of an annual in-service or pre-service, so that if you needed to train somebody today but you didn't need to train anybody tomorrow, the information would be there in a format that could be readily accessed. We didn't want it to be web-dependent, but then again, it could be accessed from the web if you desired, you know, to go that route. And we wanted to show real workers successfully implementing TB infection control at real clinical sites in Africa. We didn't want, Hollywood movie stars, pretending to be African people working in a clinical setting. That wouldn't do it. So we wanted to make it also available in English and in French for our African Francophone countries, so we didn't want to exclude them. And we also wanted to make it available for the French speakers in Haiti, so that was our emphasis on English and French. In the next slide, you'll see the front of what our material looks like. And so with this kind of solution in mind, we created this document, the Implementing TB Infection Control in Outpatient Setting Clinical Training Package. And it's based on the 2009 WHO policy on TB infection control in healthcare facilities, congregate settings, and households. So it's grounded in the WHO policy, and yet it also provides a lot of information and content on education on TB transmission, care and treatment, screening and separation, fast tracking of patients to a healthcare provider, and active situational exercises that the TB infection control lead or point person could do in order to better handle daily situations that they would come across in their practice. But most importantly, it provides guidance on the basic simple activities that promote TB infection control for the frontline clinical staff. The content of the kit contains a number of products. It has a number of supporting tools, as you'll see on the next slide. We also have facility policy templates, a variety of posters and reminder stickers for both patients and for employees throughout the outpatient facility. And as I mentioned earlier, our French version for Francophone countries is now available. At the close of my presentation, I'll give you our webpage and my email address. So if you'd like more information or copies of some of these tools, I'll be more than happy to send them to you. We try to use a very simple step-by-step process in our training. The first step is simply a background tool that gives some background information as far as what's happening in your facility, what types of patients come to your facility, who might be at risk, how many patients that you see, how your clinic operates on a daily basis. Does it have lab capacity? Does it have x-ray capacity? Just very simple things that help set the foundation. And it's that kind of information that goes on and builds on to the next step, which is the risk analysis tool. That tool targets areas that can be improved. Sometimes the improvements can be more easily remedied than others. Some take longer, some can be done very quickly. But regardless, the tool gives you the current picture of the gaps in your practice, the supplies that you need, some possible construction or renovation needs that could help you out as far as air dynamics and making for a safer environment. And with the help of your infection control committee or team, this tool also gives you a chance to write down solutions and resources and a timeline so that you can complete your thought process, your planning process. And this is something that can be reviewed either monthly by your infection control committee or quarterly, however you have it set up. Step number three allows you and the infection control committee to prioritize which items will be corrected first, second, or third based on your administration's ability and resources. By placing the problems that have been identified into this risk analysis tool that we call it, you'll have a clearer picture of what issues need to be addressed and which domain that they actually fall in, whether it's administrative or managerial, environmental, or it falls under personal protection equipment. The action items can be reviewed at each future infection control meeting and progress reported on them and then documented into the minutes of the meeting. And I'm sure that you've heard this expression before, but if it hasn't been documented, it hasn't been done. And it's really helpful to be able to have documentation showing your progress as you move along in TB infection control. And of course, step four is the actual plan. We provide a template of what an infection control plan typically contains, and the facility then inserts the action items that have been, you know, discovered and targeted by your team into that basic structure. The plan then becomes the written document for the facility, and it shows how you'll make those changes to improve care and reduce risk of TB transmission. When the plan is made available to the staff, and I encourage you to do that, it really serves as a powerful statement that your clinical site is serious about TB transmission, and it shows all the employees that everyone is included to be part of the solution. And lastly, in step five, we call it revisiting the plan, or the cycle of planning, and you'll see on the next slide, the cycle of planning includes all the steps that we just went through, but that you'll be doing this on either an annual basis. Some clinics do it every 6 months, but at least annually. I find it very helpful for sites to revise their plan yearly after a complete risk assessment and analysis has been done. And by doing this yearly, the facility can demonstrate to the Infection Control Committee, to the workers, to your health department, your community leaders, that improvements are occurring, that initiatives that maybe were missed before have now been targeted and are going to be revised, and that what areas need to be addressed possibly in the future. The other is that the documentation allows that whoever follows you, if you happen to be the TB lead person in your facility, if you go on and you move away, someone's going to be taking your place. And it's much easier for someone to follow in your footsteps knowing that there's a plan in place that they can then use as their template to continue your good work. Now I'd like to show you some examples of facilities in Africa that have successfully institutionalized some of the key infection control measures that we've been talking about into their daily practice, because to me, seeing is believing. So as you'll see in this next slide, early screening to me is very important. In fact, the earlier the better. As a patient walks into the facility and registers for care, is the perfect time to intervene. Any clerical or community worker can ask the initial screening questions that are outlined in the WHO about cough. This is a photograph of a clinic in South Africa. And as you can see sort of on the right-hand side, it looks like there's some posters on the right-hand side there. They've actually placed their policies about questioning for cough so that all the patients know, every single one, every single time they come in and they register for their visit. they know that everyone is going to be asked about cough at each and every visit. That's what that policy says. And by using what they have, which is their workers and their policy, they've initiated early screening very effectively. But this particular facility went one step further. Not only are the people screened at registration as they first come in, but they're also screened at each encounter with a clinician and with a nurse and with the ART counselor. Every single person that they interact with asks about cough, because what this team has found is that sometimes patients are not honest. They don't own up to the fact that maybe they do have a cough and it's been nagging, but you know, they don't want to talk about it or whatever. So having several people intervene and ask about cough, they are really doing a very serious job about screening their coughers, and it's now become part of the culture of the clinic, which is very important. Everybody feels that they have a vested interest in this process. And of course, being an ART clinic, they're very aware of the risk of TB. In the next slide, it talks about separation of coughers. And as you can see, nurses, educators, and community workers, just about anyone can be trained to separate coughers from a queue or a waiting line. This particular facility is in Zambia, and the facility used a team approach in their policy, which empowers all workers to intercede whenever they encounter a TB suspect. So if someone's coughing and they can't control their cough, they actually are empowered to pull them out of the queue, and they physically walk the cougher to a separate waiting area that's off to the side. And this ensures that that particular patient gets expedited care, that the patient actually gets to a care and testing site where they're quickly taken in and assessed for TB. But it also does something else. By physically walking that person over, and you can, I don't know if you can see in the slide or not, but the nurse has the patient holding her by the elbow. This gives a sense of a feeling of caring that is sometimes, you know, we miss in very busy clinical settings. So this to me is very, very important, that we want these patients to be felt like they're not being shunted off to a separate area, but they're actually being given kind of an extra layer of caring. Fast tracking to a care provider. Not only does fast tracking coughers to a care provider minimize the time TB suspects spend in a facility, but it can also be used to shorten the time in the queue to the lab, to radiology, and pharmacy departments. This particular shot shows how a number of interventions can be applied in tandem, such as the use of a surgical mask for that cougher while they're being fast-tracked to a nurse who's doing the initial cough screening. When implementing cough etiquette, all workers must set the example for cough etiquette within the clinic, and the staff should be taught to cover their own cough, either with a tissue, a cloth, or the inner aspect of their elbow. And this is very important because patients look to the staff as being those people that have the knowledge, and so we need to make sure that we're the example. In this particular shot, this outpatient clinic wanted to teach cough etiquette to all patients. And by using the cough etiquette posters that we have in our supply, they put it strategically near a waiting area where patients sometimes sit. And it made it very easy for the staff to use the poster as a teaching tool. And as I mentioned, since patients look to nurses and healthcare workers for information, they've really effectively used their staff as an educational resource. And no matter which nurse is working in this particular clinic, they all teach cough etiquette routinely. And I would highly suggest that for those of you that are instituting cough etiquette, to do some role-playing with your staff. Some of you pretend to be the coughing patient, and some of you pretend to be the nurse or whoever's interceding. And do some role-playing so that employees feel comfortable when interacting with patients and don't shy away from it. In the next slide, this particular site wanted to tackle their waiting area and congested clinic area. They really didn't have a lot of funds to do any sort of costly internal renovations to the facility. But on the left side of the slide, that's what their waiting area looked like at baseline. And you could see that it's rather narrow, congested interior space. It has low ceilings. It has doors off to the different exam rooms. I think there's four exam rooms in this clinic. They have no windows. So it's very congested. It's definitely a waiting area that's at high risk for TB transmission. But about 6 months later, we came back after we did some training in this facility, and you can see on the right, the clinic now has moved all of their patients to an outside covered awning type of area. So they're protected from the wind and the rain and so forth, but they're outside. But they did something else. The staff now only call about three or five patients at a time into the existing facility. This particular strategy is to never have more than five patients in this small space at one time. This makes for a less risky environment for both the patient and the staff throughout the day. Cough education talks are presented outside, so that patients understand the value of waiting outside. And I didn't actually see, when I visited this clinic, I take these photos, I didn't see them actually doing a cough education talk, but I did talk to a patient who was waiting in the queue, and I asked him about this approach, and he said to me that now that he understood the transmission problem, how TB was transmitted, that he really fully supports everyone waiting outside. So this has been adopted not only in the outpatient waiting area, but this particular technique was also adopted in their lab area and in their outpatient radiology area. And the staff, you know, sees a lot of patients. They'll see a couple of hundred patients a day, but they have their administrator's support for working on a healthier environment. So I'd like to take a look now at lab turnaround time. Trying to track lab turnaround time with disorganized papers and test results, you know, everywhere is difficult at best. And once a facility starts organizing their lab data into a system that's accessible, this particular clinic started using three-ring binders. Now, three-ring binders isn't anything, you know, it's not rocket science, but it allows them to have their materials organized. They can quickly track down turnaround times, missing lab results, and it also shows to people coming in from the outside, such as me, validation as far as how many tests that they're doing, what kind of tests are being ordered, when they're submitted, when they're returned. And it also allows the clinic administrator valuable information for budgeting, for testing costs, for lab maintenance costs, and for equipment costs. So the purchase of a three-ring binder is very, very small when you think about the value that's given through being able to, you know, get your hands around turnaround times, missing lab results, and then also things like lab maintenance, equipment costs, testing costs, you know, those sort of things. So there's lots of valuable information that can be obtained just by simply organizing those lab results. As stated in the World Health Organization 2009 policy document, other administrative control measures, such as minimizing diagnostic delays, is really very, very important. Patients with TB symptoms should have the ability to access prompt diagnosis, diagnostic evaluation, and treatment very, very quickly, because we know that the longer we delay getting people on appropriate TB medications, the greater the chance that they'll be lost to follow-up and that TB in the community will continue to spread. As we see in the next slide, there are other occupational health issues that also fall under the domain of administrative control, such as ensuring that there are annual evaluations for TB and that all workers are offered confidential HIV testing. It also includes free medication for TB and HIV treatment. For those who are HIV positive but do not have active TB, free isoniazid preventive therapy should be offered as endorsed by the WHO, and of course a confidential log of staff diagnosed with TB should be maintained with the screening dates, when they were started on treatment, what department they work in, and when they were cleared to return to work. And I know that that's kind of a tough nut for many institutions to handle, but the next slide shows you a solution that I saw recently in Botswana that I wanted to share with you. This particular facility started annual screening for both TB and HIV within their healthcare workers. The matron at this particular clinic wanted to ensure that the staff had been screened, but they also wanted to make sure that the information was truly confidential, that they wanted the staff to know that if we're going to be doing this screening, no one is going to get this information other than those who have a definite need to know. And so this was the solution that she came up with. It's a lockable logbook, and only she has the keys. And this lockable logbook is kept inside a locked cabinet whenever it's not in use. And not only is this locked logbook in a locked cabinet, but the door to her office is also lockable. So we've got three layers of locked protection here. And she keeps her key on this teddy bear key ring holder that I included in here in the photograph, just to show you this is a real person and this is what they were doing. But even though it may look a little funny, it works for this particular site, and the matron now has a means of collecting data, tracking and trending TB in her workers over time. And no longer does she have to rely on anecdotal stories. The logbook provides the means for continuity of information that is transferable to the next person that takes that matron's place. So this is something that's working in this particular facility, and it's being shared with other facilities throughout the region in Botswana. And who knows, the next time I go to Botswana, all the facilities I go to may have key rings with teddy bears. Who knows? But it's a solution. It's a start to see what works, what might work in your facility. The next slide shows a tool to capture data in a facility to monitor whether proper ventilation throughout the clinic is being maintained. Each day, a person is assigned to make sure that the doors and the windows are open, the fans are turned on, the curtains are tied back so as not to impede airflow. On the left-hand side of this piece of paper, you can see that there's a list of activities to be monitored, and across the top are the days of the month, and at the bottom is the responsible person signs off, indicating that he or she has checked to see that these activities have been done for the day. The workers at this particular clinic created this tool. I had no hand in it. But when I saw this clinic, I was very impressed, not only by the good ventilation practices that I witnessed, but the pride shown by the staff that ventilation was being addressed each and every day, and it was being documented. And speaking of documentation, This next slide shows some selected indicators for healthcare centers that you might want to consider. You can clearly see that they have measured their compliance in these targeted task areas. One of them is noted, monitor daily practices, training for staff, material available, and so forth. This graph was created on an Excel spreadsheet that comes with most laptops, so there's no special software that's required. But what's interesting is that in 6 months' time, and you can see that the first measurement was in February, and the next measurement that was taken was in September, and you can see the dramatic improvement in compliance. And to me, I could take this information and present this at CDC or WHO as showing that this monitoring actually does result in improved compliance. So I think anyone can easily understand the significance achieved just in 6 months at this facility. And so I think for healthcare workers in particular, they want to know that their performance is improving, that what you're measuring, they want feedback. And so I think it's very important that not only do you share information like this with upper management, but you also share this with the workers within your facility. If you want to take this one step further and you want to compare facilities, as we see in this next slide, we have 10 facilities noted across the top line that are being compared to a list of indicators that you see on the right for TB infection control. You can see that this is a baseline sample of TB infection control indicators that they've adopted, and that you can see by the color coding that the red are areas where they need a lot of work, the orange are areas where they're making some improvements, and green is they've got it all together. So you can see very quickly a lot of information, and this is very helpful, especially for ministries of health, to understand what clinics need special help and those clinics that are already adopting and putting into practice TB infection control measures. So now that we've covered some of that information, I'd like to briefly talk about considerations for scale-up. TB infection control measures really lend themselves nicely to quality improvement because QI tends to look at the reliability of the processes that lead to our outcomes. Currently, 12 ministries of health use HIVQOL and HealthQOL platforms and methodologies to develop, enhance, and refine their process improvement and look at outcomes of care. For those listeners that are not familiar with HIVQOL and HealthQOL, the methodology between the two is fairly identical in that HIVQOL focuses on the monitoring of clinical care indicators within HIV care delivery facilities, and HealthQOL is characterized by kind of a broader focus that's more population-based health and building capacity at the national, regional, and facility level to support clinical data collection and analysis. HealthQOL as an organization provides training, technical assistance, paper-based tools, software programs, and so forth. So if you're interested in that, I can help connect you to those folks. But the example that I wanted to show was that really the documentation within HealthQOL and HIVQOL, the routine screening of healthcare workers and so forth, this, as far as being adopted, has been very, very slow. But in those countries that have been using HIVQOL and HealthQOL, they seem to do an uptake. There seems to be more acceptance of this as a monitoring focus. So as more and more ART sites merge with TB care and treatment sites, I think it's important to provide a very integrated approach into patient care. And I think we're going to be seeing TB infection control being integrated more and more into National Infection Control Guidelines. For those of us in that are workers, it's going to require that nurses and physicians and other allied healthcare personnel be trained to expect that integrated approaches to infection control and TB measures be adopted. And the possibility of accreditation programs for hospitals is being investigated in a number of countries for inclusion both in public settings and private settings in a number of countries, which is very exciting. Some of them are looking at ways of adding basic TB and infection control standards into the mix of structural and environmental healthcare standards. So as we see these TB infection control measures evolving, we're going to be seeing the standard, I think, of patient quality care improving. CDC actually has started using an implementation scorecard for our PEPFAR-supported clinical sites. So believe me, we're going to be doing some checking and things like that and putting them on a scorecard, too, for all sorts of things like medication management, TB infection control, quality improvement, testing and counseling, just a whole host of things. But the point here is that we want to ensure that the best healthcare practices are being operationalized and will be sustained in the future, and that I think adopting integrated approaches to care and merging international standards of better practices is the best thing to support our patients and the healthcare workers who deliver their care. So just as a recap, we've covered a lot of information. We've talked about the burden of TB and HIV co-infection in sub-Saharan Africa. I talked about the role of PEPFAR and the scale-up of care and treatment. We touched on the World Health Organization 2009 policy, and then we looked at some of the challenges of TB implementation. I talked about our TB training materials. I've shared some slides with some solutions that some countries are using for your consideration, and I hope I've given you some food for thought and some ideas that you might wish to try in your own facility. Just as an acknowledgement, I have a slide here. No one does anything all by themselves. My CDC teammates in Atlanta and in Africa have been tremendously helpful and supportive of TB infection control, and I wanted to acknowledge them. And then the last slide, as promised, if you'd like to download samples or some of our training material, or you have a question for me, my email address is there. So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today, and we might have time for one or two questions. Thank you.
Ginny, thank you so much for that. A huge amount of information within that teleclass, and certainly possible to summarize all of that information, and I suppose one could think that each or one of those slides could be a lecture in itself. A couple of points to tease out there. It's really interesting to hear how you mentioned that the initial genesis of the HIV-TB connection and the fact that actually universal access to antiretroviral treatment led to crowding, which ultimately led to the issues that you're clearly trying to tackle. Now, this probably emphasizes the fact that diseases ultimately end up in the same health system. And it was really interesting to hear at the end how you are working with colleagues on scale-up in integrating TB control measures with IPC guidelines at the national level. Just coming to a couple of potential questions, you mentioned on a few occasions within the teleclass the linkage between decreasing transmission of TB, decreasing the reactivation of latent TB, but of course the third part of that triad is decreasing HIV transmission itself.
Yeah.
Perhaps if you could give some reflections on how the work that you're focused on in terms of decreasing transmission of TB could and has been linked up with the decreasing HIV transmission.
Oh, guys, that's an entire lecture in itself, too. The ART sites that PEPFAR supports, now that we are beginning to see more merging of both TB treatment sites into ART treatment sites, it really behooves us to ensure that these populations, and sometimes these co-infected populations, have the same access to good care. And what we've discovered over time is that treating ART patients and then possibly sending them then to another clinic to have them treat their TB, these folks are sometimes lost to follow-up. And so by making it easier and convenient, very much like, you know, if you have HIV, it used to be you would take a handful of different pills, and now we've got it down to maybe one or two pills a day. Mm. And the same thing goes for care and treatment. If we can do more kind of one-stop shopping for our patients, we have a better chance of keeping them and linking them into care and getting them the treatments that they need and the medications that they need, and not losing them to follow up, because it's a much more efficient use of their time. Sometimes patients take 3, 4, 6 hours to get to a clinic, and then to have to wait all day. We want to make sure that everyone is efficiently using their time. But as far as HIV treatment goes, certainly, if we can, with the patient education tools that we have available right now, and the various other groups within CDC that are tackling the HIV prevention side, there's opportunities, more opportunities now than ever before, to use the clinical facilities as a springboard for prevention, educational prevention.
It's clearly an incredibly complex area, but essentially what we face continuously as a challenge are the health services that are meeting all of these needs simultaneously, as you very much highlighted within your teleclass. Ginny, just one further question is, clearly PEPFAR activities have amassed a huge body of knowledge on TB, HIV care in African health settings. Now, in all of that, volumes of knowledge that have, I'm sure, been compiled, are there any nuggets or elements of that learning that could potentially be fed into TB, HIV care in the United States?
I definitely think so. The one of the things that the U.S. is adopting and adapting very quickly is the movement toward mid-level providers, and that we've already seen quite effectively in Africa, so that if there's not enough physicians that are available to use nurse practitioners or RNs that have special training in areas that can deliver care and treatment within the scope of their training, in those areas where we have very limited resources in physicians. And so that, I think, is something that is a very positive aspect that we've seen work very, very effectively in Africa that we can certainly adopt here.
Thank you, Ginny. Thank you very much for the teleclass and for all of the perspectives that you provided within the teaching here. Specifically, I think the fact that you are able to draw on so many case studies of successful approaches really hopefully gives us hope that some of these approaches can then be taken and moved on further to more and more health facilities across the African Pacific and beyond. Thank you again.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you.